There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman-Ellen. I'm your host. On today's program, well, the Supreme Court weighs in on some effing indecency. And it's kind of a narrow signal. As well, now some commercial radio stations are asking their listeners to donate so they can stay on the air. We'll be catching up with this and all sorts of other radio stuff. My pal John Anderson of DIYmedia.net. You do want to stay tuned. Hey, John. Thanks for joining me again.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
So did they go? They went into this with a scalpel, didn't they? The Supreme Court in this decision on fleeting expletives.
Yeah, it was a very anticlimactic decision. Just to give the listeners a little bit of background, this case initially involved, I think it was Fox television stations, who were fined a certain amount of money for fleeting expletives said by celebrities, essentially during live televised awards programs. And the FCC ruled that even though these were fleeting, meaning that they were unintentional and they were not, meant to shock, pander, or titillate, as is typically defined by the FCC's content analysis for indecency, they were still broadcast outside of safe harbor and reached enough people that they could have harmed people, and therefore they did count as indecent speech, and Fox was fined, I think it was like $325,000.
Mm-hmm.
And initially what they did is they paid the fine, because one of the things you have to do to get standing in the federal courts to challenge an FCC ruling is to exhaust all your administrative remedies. So instead of arguing this point with the FCC, they just paid the fine and said, we'll see you in court. And so the case went to court, and it was initially Fox Television Stations versus FCC. I think it was in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yes, yeah, Second Circuit,
as opposed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is interesting because they removed it out of the Beltway jurisdiction, which is typically where you hear most FCC-related court cases. And the Second Circuit essentially overturned what the FCC had did. They ruled that the FCC's indecency policy with regards to fleeting expletives especially had no constitutional bearings on it whatsoever. And on those grounds, as well as grounds that the FCC really kind of convoluted itself like a pretzel with its existing indecency mm-hmm. regulations to fine Fox, they said, fine overturned, ruling overturned FCC, you lose. And the FCC appealed the case to the Supreme Court, which is why it became FCC versus Fox television stations. And the Supreme Court took the case, heard arguments on it, and ruled this week that essentially the FCC's administrative procedures and rationales for issuing the fine that they did against Fox were okay. That there was nothing wrong with the way the FCC administratively justified its decision to fine Fox. But it refused to rule on the inherent constitutionality of the FCC's indecency regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And so the case is actually going back to the Second Circuit Court, where essentially a rehearing will be held to further develop the case. And so the FCC the Supreme Court made a decision, but has told the Second Circuit, it's up to you to ultimately determine the boundaries of this decision. Now, the Second Circuit Court has already ruled that they feel the FCC's indecency policy is unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court, in its majority decision, actually says, we're declining to take up the constitutionality of this issue, and it's very likely we may have to decide that in this very case, meaning they might expect it to come back in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
But on the grounds that they simply ruled that the FCC had the right to fine Fox for those fleeting expletives. They didn't make fleeting expletives illegal as a precedent for case law, nor did they actually endorse the FCC's indecency policy as written. That's why this is, you know, kind of a non-story story, in that it's a case that cannot be used to set policy.
Right.
It is a case that will affect policy down the road, but those court hearings and those decisions have yet to actually be made. So the FCC was vindicated for finding in this specific instance, but the policy that the FCC uses to define what indecency is was not vindicated, and the Supreme Court's actually told the lower court, look at that issue more closely.
Right, with specific regard to constitutionality. They sort of were administratively backed up by the Supreme Court, but not constitutionally vindicated.
Right, and the Supreme Court explicitly said, we're not considering the constitutionality of this argument. We're only considering this in the context of, does the FCC have the administrative power to do what they did?
And did they act appropriately,
properly,
according
yes.
to what you would expect from an administration? And it's my understanding that, generally speaking, the Supreme Court is loath to intervene in the administrative underpinnings of most regulatory agencies, unless they're very highly motivated and very much pushed, in that they're not interested in really tinkering with how business is done, provided it meets, you know, fairly, I would say, probably minimal guidelines.
Yeah, and the same, and also courts in general, all the federal courts in general, will give deferential treatment to an agency like the FCC because it deals with obscure law that judges do not deal with on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Communications law is such a small sliver of the legal, you know, world that the courts are loath to delve their feet into issues where they're not technically knowledgeable or literate, and where their decisions could actually have the reverse implications than what they might, because they don't understand the field as well. So, yeah, the FCC was going in kind of with the deck stacked in its favor, because the highest court in the land is not going to dictate the FCC's indecency policy to it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember, though, that it was a court case, back in 1968, I think it was, that gave the FCC the ability to even define what indecency was.
Mm-hmm.
And this
are you referring to Red Lion v. FCC?
No, Pacifica versus FCC.
That was 78.
78, which is where we had the creation of safe harbor hours, mm-hmm. And things like that, where for the first time indecency was officially codified as an administrative rule.
Mm-hmm.
And, so really the entire aspect, even within what the FCC's regulatory sphere is, this particular part is only something they've been dealing with for 30 years
right.
of their 75-year history.
Well, and yet it does rest on the back of Red Lion v. FCC, which enshrined as constitutional that the FCC could regulate speech to begin with.
Because of scarcity on the spectrum.
Because of establishing the scarcity argument, and the Pacifica v. FCC definitely hangs on Red Lion. And I know
right.
that there are many conservatives and libertarians and who've been hoping that the challenge on indecency would throw Red Lion in front
argument.
Of the Supreme Court, and it looks like the Supreme Court moved very deftly in order to avoid those pylons.
It was an artful dodge of a can of worms.
Yes, it definitely was. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of the Second Circuit, since the Second Circuit did not seem to be particularly enamored of the FCC's indecency regime to begin with. I wonder what they'll make of the instruction from the Supremes.
You know, I think what is going to happen, and I'm taking my opinion here based on the opinions of others who have not only read the entire decision but also the dissenting opinions and work in this field full-time as communications lawyers, is that the Second Circuit's already pretty much made up its mind with regard to the constitutionality of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the Supreme Court said we're not explicitly going to consider the constitutionality issue, but we know that it's that thing hanging over the case ultimately, many communications lawyers are saying it's just going to bounce back to the Second Circuit, who's going to pretty much reaffirm what it already decided and send it back to the Supreme Court and put it in its lap, because ultimately they're the arbiters. You know,
but and at that point, though, it will be a constitutional question rather than one of administrative propriety.
And so in this case, the Supreme Court punted until they get a stronger signal from the Second Circuit that the Supreme Court is needed to define the constitutionality of the FCC's indecency policy, and there is when the real news will be made. I don't know what the schedule is for the Second Circuit, you know, rehearing the case and things like that, but I would expect, you know, it's going to be a year or so before we really have some sort of quasi-resolution in this thing.
And so in the meantime...
Yeah. In the interim, the FCC is not going to go on an indecency binge. You know,
you don't think? I mean, you don't have Martin at the helm any longer.
Don't have Kevin Martin at the helm. The indecency czarina that he appointed, you know, to head up this effort to clean up the airwaves for family-friendly, you know, programming and things like that, has pretty much been occupying her office and has not been doing jack blank. I'd be very surprised if that titular posting even stayed in place under a fully constituted Obama administration FCC.
Of course, we're still waiting for Jenichowski to be confirmed by the Senate.
We just got word today of the next potential FCC appointee, who is a member of the South Carolina Public Service Commission and also the daughter of a pretty influential lawmaker. I can't remember what her name is now.
The person who has been
Mingan Clyburn.
Mingan Clyburn, yes.
And her
it's her dad, who's the House Majority Whip. Yes,
is Jim Clyburn. So she's probably going to make it onto the commission.
Yeah, no worries. It's just a matter of when the Senate gets around to it.
Right, and so
because we've been waiting on Jenichowski now for a month.
Yeah,
they're a little backed up there.
And there's been some discussion that. The Senate will essentially work through all of the new nominations as a package. So one of the reasons why Jenichowski's deliberation in front of the Senate has been held up is because I've been waiting for the Obama administration to name the people that's going to, you know, join him on the FCC.
And the Republicans have not been moving forward, because usually the Republican senators recommend the Republican nominee to the FCC, and they're kind of hanging on that too. I mean, some names have been floated, but there's no one seems to be the heir apparent.
Right, and so you have that going on. So you have this what I call, you know, regulatory flux taking place right now in Washington D.C., and on top of that, you have all of these different other priorities. In the communications policy world that the FCC is actively engaged in right now. For example, while they are not directly engaged in the disbursement of stimulus money, they are one of the agencies that's going to work to develop data on who should get the stimulus money, right? Broadband mapping initiatives and things like that.
Right.
What should be done with the 700 megahertz spectrum and ultimately how that should be handled. There's still an outstanding part of that spectrum that hasn't been auctioned off. There is still a DTV transition underway. You have all of these things that are taking place that are just going to occupy the FCC's time and energy and intellectual and policymaking ability for so long that really indecency is way down on the list.
And there's no award shows coming up. Right. There's no big award shows coming up, I think, until the fall.
No. And, you know, Michael Copps, the acting chairman of the FCC, has been the one Democrat who has been, for better or for worse, the only person to speak up in slight favor of making for more family-friendly programming. But it's been a rhetorical position of his, not necessarily something. He hasn't followed Kevin Martin's lead when Kevin Martin was, you know, appointing an indecency czarina and things like that. And so I don't think he's going to take the opportunity in his time and power right now to try to, you know, extend the FCC's indecency enforcement efforts or even clarify the regulations. He's going to just let the courts handle this.
Right.
And then they'll take their place from the courts.
Unless someone hands him something on a silver platter, which he cannot ignore.
Mm-hmm.
Like a big F-bomb. In the middle, you know, in a big live broadcast or something, that he might have his hand pushed.
Right.
But
then in that case, you know, the FCC will have to make a consideration under the rules that they have And because the political atmosphere in the FCC itself is much different now, and the priorities of what's considered to be an egregious offense are much different right now, there's the potential that if someone drops a big F-bomb, they'll get fined $50,000 or $20,000 as opposed to $325,000, right? And because the FCC knows that its entire policy is somewhat still up in the air, they won't step outside of their statutory authority. They won't look to use Fox Television or FCC versus Fox Television stations preliminary rulings as precedent in another administrative action. That would actually be irresponsible and could open up that administrative action to further court challenge. See, so the FCC's kind of its hands are kind of tied right now. And the courts haven't clarified the situation except to say that in the particular instance of Fox, they did not overstep their administrative authority. That's the end. That's all they said. What the range of that administrative authority should be, what kind of speech falls under the prohibitions allowed by that authority, still an open question.
Well, let's go then to the news you alluded to before, that as we go to air today on April the 30th, that Mignon Clyburn has been nominated as an additional FCC commissioner, coming from the South Carolina Public Service Commission, where she served since 1998. Her father, Jim Clyburn, who's the House Majority Whip and the third ranking position in leadership and the highest ranking African American. What do we know about her? It's like almost as mysterious as Mr. Jenichowski was when news of his impending nomination was first leaked. Everyone, I guess, was ran off to the LexisNexis, which I haven't had a chance to do yet, to see what we can dig up on this woman.
Well, we don't know that much about her as of yet, other than her education is limited to a bachelor's degree. She graduated in 1984 with a Bachelor of Science in Banking, Finance, and Economics. Before she was elected to the PSC, she was the publisher and general manager of a weekly newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina. So she obviously has some media connections there, and knows what it's like to actually be a practitioner of journalism, especially print journalism. And I think most importantly, she's in charge of essentially, currently she's serving an appointment as the point person for what's basically the trade group that lobbies Washington on behalf of state utility commissioners. So there's this group called the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners, and they represent all the state utility commissions, right? And so when state utility commissions, either from Wisconsin or Tennessee or Illinois or South Carolina, have issues, they lobby through this national professional organization that they have, and she is currently in charge of handling the point position on the Hill. So we do know, A, she's well engaged in state regulatory issues and knows the national landscape, which I think is very important, because a lot of things that have been happening in our communications world have been state initiatives, right? Where industry is not able to block, say, municipal broadband in Congress, so they go to every state capital. So she's aware that those issues are taking place, which I think is very important. And secondly, she's been working actively on the Hill, so she has good connections with lawmakers, whereas and before, the FCC has always been kind of this black sheep which gets called in to the woodshed occasionally. I think, her confirmation hearing is going to be one of plaudits and praise.
So here's a little bit of dirt. This comes courtesy of Art Brodsky, who's Communications Director of Public Knowledge. Public Knowledge is a public interest group with many talented folks on board.
Harold Feld's working there now.
Harold Feld, a legal tour de force, formerly with the Media Access Project, and the person who helped to eviscerate the FCC's attempt to loosen media ownership rules back in 2003 and helped to throw them upon the stake of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So Art Brodsky, who's also quite an astute observer, says that, and this is quote, over the past 10 years as a member of the PSC, Clyburn has gone along with the normal pro-Bell tilt to the commission. As one telecom attorney with experience in the southern state put it, if a competitive carrier went to the South Carolina Commission to argue that the sky was blue and AT&T argued the sky was purple, the PSC would rule in favor of purple.
Well, that makes sense. One of the things also she's been involved in at NARUC is what they call the Market Access Partnership Board, mm-hmm. the Utilities Market Access Partnership Board. I don't know a lot about what that issue is, but I'm assuming that it is a way to develop public-private partnerships that would essentially diminish public sector authority. I don't think anybody we're going to get out of the Obama administration's appointments to the FCC are going to be flaming radicals, or anything like that.
Nor necessarily flaming advocates of AT&T.
Right. I do not think that Jonathan Adelstein is replaceable.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
I think he's an irreplaceable loss, and it's good that he's going to be overseeing the expansion of broadband in rural areas. I think there's nobody better qualified and suited for that, but he will be a loss to the FCC, and there will be no Jonathan Adelstein, and Mingyan Clyburn is no Jonathan Adelstein. But because she is aware of issues that are taking place, and because she's going to be in a new position, who knows what she's going to do.
Right, and as you mentioned, she will greatly understand the telecommunications landscape.
True, and what has been happening at a state-by-state level, too. Mm-hmm. So if there are issues that could be resolved at the federal level, maybe she will take a more proactive stance on behalf of all these state utilities commissions who are trying to develop patchwork regulation to harmonize them. Now, whether or not the question of the harmonization is good or bad, private sector neoliberal versus potentially more public sector free market in the true sense competition, we don't know. Then again, let's look at the history of other members of the FCC. Kathleen Abernathy, Republican member, the quietest member on the FCC, came from the Tennessee Public Utilities Commission. She hasn't turned out to be anything, special or wonderful either.
Right.
She's been no more than a placeholder who basically followed in whatever Kevin Martin said. Is Ms. Clyburn going to be a placeholder that will follow whatever Jenikowski says?
Right.
That's a possibility, but I'm not willing to discount Ms. Clyburn until I actually see her in action.
Mm-hmm.
And the record of her background is more fully developed. And again, it'll be people like Art Brodsky who are going to do that.
And I'm certain our friend in San Francisco and currently
Lazar,
in New York,
yeah.
currently I'm sorry, Washington, Matthew Lazar is working on it right now. I think that the wireless in his apartment right now in D.C. is warm. I think you can feel the bits pulsating as he's pulling up data. So I'm sure he'll be writing for that soon at Ars Technica, and I'll dig down when I get a chance. But it should be interesting. One other thing I sort of promised to talk about, and I figure we could throw out here, is a recent Wall Street Journal story about commercial radio stations now themselves begging for donations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. First, they tried going back to the dollar a holler spot method, which is, buy as many commercials as you want on our station for just a dollar, and nobody bid at that. And now they're actually, asking for listener support. How ironic is that for an industry that has spent the last 10 years marketing itself as free radio?
That's right. Well, and it hangs on the fact that I guess Air America is now considering having a membership program. And I think I heard this. I was listening to Air America. I was on the road back and forth from your old haunt, Madison, this week, and tuned into some Air America on the way. And heard them talking about some sort of membership program which would give you access to their podcasts, or maybe get them ahead of time or get better access to podcasts. I wasn't entirely sure what you get out of the deal, and some other things. And this article mentions that they might the top donors may get access to Air America talent. Woo! You go have dinner have drinks with Ron Reagan, I guess.
Yeah.
Ron Reagan Jr. I don't know what talent they have left. A lot of talent left.
I kind of lost track of Air America there for a second.
You're not alone.
That's right.
You're not alone about that.
Still exist. Well, that's a little different from an individual radio station or a radio station conglomerate trying to do. I mean, like NPR does the same thing, right?
Sure.
We're a network. We're running stuff. If you want to help continue the programming, please give us money, and we'll give you premiums. You know, and you could see this as Air America, which, to be completely and utterly honest, was founded by people that had no idea how the radio industry works. I know the people. I met the people when they were the angel donors who were founding, and they had no idea what they were getting themselves into. They did not hire enough staff. They went on the air before their production studios were even complete. I knew someone who was hired on, and she would call me and say, "There are wires hanging down. We still don't have phone interfaces. How the hell are we supposed to do to call and talk radio without phone interfaces?" And I'm like, "You guys are screwed, you know?"
Right.
And then they went through a period where they were the angel funders backed off. It looked like Air America was going to go into bankruptcy. So the whole thing has been just kind of an abortion from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that they're sinking to this level of asking for things does not surprise me. And because Air America is exclusively trying to promote itself to liberal audiences who also might, if they weren't listening to Air America, would be listening to NPR, would therefore be potentially more amenable to opening up their wallets to support this type of programming. The fact, though, that commercial ventures are looking for donations from listeners is still just highly ironic to me.
Right, and two other stations mentioned in the article. One is a talk radio station in Santa Cruz, California, KSCO, which they say hasn't turned a profit in 18 years.
Yeah.
And the owner, Michael Zwirling, goes on the air and asks people to donate by PayPal.
Now, do you know what they need to do? Is they need to just give over their radio station to Freak Radio Santa Cruz.
Well, exactly.
Who probably has more money in the bank right now than they do.
That's exactly. Freak Radio Santa Cruz, a long-running, unlicensed pirate station in Santa Cruz, California. And it also mentions a station, WJIB, which is in the... In the Massachusetts area, and one WJTO in Bath, Maine, also asking for money, all running adult standards music, which they say is greatly ignored.
Radio stations?
Yeah, I get the sense that they are. Yeah, independently owned, so they're not clear channel stations.
They're running a format where the listeners are dying.
Mm-hmm, precisely. Mm. You know, and the thing is you know, the way I look at it is if you're a commercial station. And you want to flip over to being non-commercial, you can do that, right? I mean, and in fact, a lot of non-commercial stations, including Pacifica's New York affiliate, WBAI, it's actually a commercial license. There's no obligation to run commercials. All the commercial license means is that you're permitted to run commercials. These stations, why don't they turn them over? Turn them over to the community. Turn them into community radio stations. Turn them nonprofit. I'm just not very interested in giving money to stations that are also running ads for male enhancement formula or skin cream or C rations or whatever that they're hawking these days. You know, ditch the commercials and turn it over to the community. Maybe I'd be interested in throwing you a couple of bones.
Well, you know, this is something that is the continuation of a trend which we talked about the last time that I was on the air with you, which is the continuing, increasingly desperate state of the radio industry, economically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Publicly traded and even privately held companies now like Clear Channel are suffering immensely, and it is no surprise that the mom and pop stations are the first ones to break this taboo and start asking for money. But it's perfectly in line with the financial decline that is affecting all radio stations, whether they are consolidated or not. The next thing I would love to hear is Clear Channel stations asking for money. They won't go that far. They're too busy cutting to the bone.
Well, John, we've come to the end of another program.
It's already been an hour, man?
It's already been an hour, man.
Oh, F-bomb. I had so much to say.
Well, thank you, John. I'm really glad that you're continuing to do your work at DIYmedia.net and working away on that dissertation, which I will be eager to read when you're completed. And I'm glad that you keep coming on to share this knowledge with us on a regular basis.
Anytime, my friend.
All right. Have a good evening.
And that
brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back one more week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog and at the radio show site. It's radio.MediaGeek.net. Listen in your browser or download the MP3, however you like. Thanks for tuning in.